This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, as the crisis in Ukraine dominates headlines, we revisit the conflict and humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which is entering its eighth year as peace talks stall. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Yemen UN World Food Program Director Richard Regan wrote in an opinion piece for USA Today, quote, "I am not suggesting that it is wrong for global attention to focus on Ukraine now. The crisis there is hot, the stakes are high, and the human suffering is unforgivable. But for every bomb that falls in a Ukrainian city, the reverberations will be felt thousands of miles away in terms of the cost of a loaf of bread, bag of flour, or can of oil," unquote. Regan states that the ripple effects are already being felt in Yemen in the form of rising food, fuel, and fertilizer costs, which exacerbate the devastating impact on Yemenis already hungry and living in conflict. He reminds that Ukraine and Russia together supply about 30% of the global wheat market, and prices for this staple have increased by more than 50%. According to the Sufan Center, a New York-based research group, the conflict between the Iran-backed Houthi movement and the Republic of Yemen government has, until recently, been confined to Yemen and the southern territories of Saudi Arabia. But since January 2022, the conflict has broadened with four Houthi-initiated missile and drone attacks on the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, Riyadh's main coalition partner in the war. On Sunday, March 20th, the Associated Press reported that the Houthi rebels attacked Saudi Arabia's critical energy facilities using drone and missile strikes, sparking a fire at one site and temporarily halting oil production at another. According to a Houthi spokesman, the attack was in retaliation for, quote, "the Saudi-led aggression and blockade that has turned Yemen into a wasteland." The AP further reports that the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grunberg, met with the chief Houthi negotiator and Omani officials to discuss a possible truce during the holy month of Ramadan in early April, unquote. For the latest on the conflict in Yemen and the deteriorating humanitarian situation exacerbated by the crisis in Ukraine, we turn to two regional experts. Catherine Zimmerman is a fellow in Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, as well as an advisor to AEI's Critical Threats Project. And she is a valued analyst at these microphones. And Nadwa Dawsari, she is a Yemeni analyst and a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, a think tank also based in Washington. And both women join us via Microsoft Teams. Catherine and Nadwa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to be back, Carol.
Well, thank you both. And Katie, let me begin with you. Catherine, you and I spoke at these microphones some 6 or so months ago, and sadly, this war continues. Can you give us the state of play on the ground, especially since the conflict has been so overshadowed by the Ukraine crisis?
The state of play has actually changed significantly since we last spoke, Carol. When we're looking at the players on the ground, we have the Houthis on one side, who, of course, seized control of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, in September of 2014, and have since held most of northwest Yemen fairly uncontested. And then against them, there are fractious Yemeni forces fighting, including the internationally recognized Yemeni government, and then some other southern militias and various tribal forces. What happened over the course of the fall was the Houthis engaged in a very major push against a key province neighboring Sana'a, the capital. And they got very close to taking over the province. And it actually evoked numerous worries from observers here in Washington and elsewhere, as well as from Yemenis on the ground, that the Houthis were close to consolidating their victory. Of course, we are still in this war, so that didn't happen. There was a counteroffensive against them stoked in part by the Emiratis re-engaging some of the forces they'd worked with previously. And then what we saw in January was the Houthis attacking the United Arab Emirates directly. So what we have seen fundamentally was a brief shift in the lines on the ground inside of Yemen, with the background of some internal fighting as well in the course of the civil war. But fundamentally, the expansion of the scope of this conflict beyond Yemen's borders and the borders of Saudi Arabia.
Well, thank you for that, Catherine. And it sounds very dire. I'd like now to turn to Nadwa. Nadwa, you were recently in Yemen. What would you add to Katie's analysis and what did you observe?
So I was in Yemen last month. I was mainly in Aden and I visited several southern governorates. And before then, I was in Aden in mid-2019. When I went this time, I was extremely shocked, not by the security situation. I felt fine and safe, but by the food prices. And this was all before Ukraine thing happened. The food prices have increased massively compared to 2019. I have no idea how people are surviving. I've heard stories of people dying in their own homes because they're too proud to ask for help and they have no means of helping themselves. So I would say, to me, this is the most distressful aspect of Yemen war at the moment. The military situation, the conflict, this has been more or less a stalemate for the past 3 years at least. But the humanitarian situation unfolding is something I'm really, really concerned about. I know many people are. But on the ground, it's even much worse than what you hear in the news.
Turning back to you, Catherine, what would you like to add to what Nadwa said about the humanitarian crisis? As we said, it's bad enough when she was there just a little over a month ago. But now with this Ukraine crisis, shortages of wheat, as Russia and Ukraine are among the largest producers of such commodities, this has got to be devastating. What is the UN and other organizations doing to address this situation in Yemen?
Certainly the UN and other international aid organizations are trying to get assistance for Yemen, but they face many obstacles. The first obstacle, of course, is the fact that there is broad donor fatigue, right? We have crises in Yemen, in Eastern Africa, in Afghanistan, now a major crisis in Europe, and the international willingness to donate to these crises are going down. Second, when we look at getting goods into Yemen, it's a challenge. The Houthis blame the Saudis for a blockade, and certainly the Saudi sea and air blockade plays a role. But beyond that, once the goods do get into the country, we see groups on the ground, in particular the Houthis, politicize the distribution of the humanitarian assistance, moving it across the country, and even accessing the people most in need is really difficult. I think something that we miss when we think of Yemen is the fact that the Yemeni population is not concentrated inside of urban centers. So you can't simply get it to a major city and feed millions of people. Yemenis are distributed across a very rugged terrain. And so, as Nadwa pointed out, it's very difficult, even when people do want to access aid, for them to get to it.
Nadwa, what would you add to the obstacles Catherine just mentioned?
Humanitarian aid is actually not sustainable the way it's been done over the past years. I add to what Katie said about the politicizing of aid. There's also major corruption in aid as well. I've spoken to some civil society groups that work with IDPs, and they complained about aid because aid creates disparity between IDPs and host communities because all the aid goes to the IDPs while the host communities cannot afford food, and that creates resentment, especially in the South where most of the IDPs come from the North. So it fuels the anti-North sentiment in the South. Aid also teaches dependency. So I'd like to see a shift, and I think there's some discussions by the UNMWA and others as well, to go beyond providing food and kind of work to create economic opportunities for Yemenis. Now, the major challenge, of course, is the war economy, because increasingly armed actors, the Houthis top the list, but others as well, have been making tons of money from manufacturing cooking gas and fuel crises, both in the North and in the South. And the absence of the government and the corruption, government corruption as well, does not help in that aspect.
Well, back to you, Catherine, to talk about the conflict itself and the proxy war that we're seeing going on, the Saudis backing the official government of Abu Mansur Hadi, the nominal president, and of course, the Iranians backing the Houthis. How much of a role do both of them have in just perpetuating this conflict? Talk about their roles as obstacles, one could say, and exacerbating the war.
Certainly, the Saudi-Iranian conflict has changed how the Yemeni war has developed over the years and has created a regional conflict on top of what fundamentally was a Yemeni-based issue. When we're looking at some of the challenges, the way that Saudi Arabia has prosecuted its military intervention has exacerbated the humanitarian situation on the ground. I already mentioned the Saudi Aran Sea blockade. There's some phenomenal research that shows that some of the blockade efforts to prevent the Houthis from making money off of fuel imports, for example, hasn't worked because the Houthis have found workarounds in this war economy that Nedwa mentioned. And the goods are still going into Yemen. It's significant in terms of what's still able to transit in terms of illicit smuggling networks that enter the country. When we add on top of that, the Saudi air campaign, we're all familiar with how horrible that has been for Yemenis on the ground. It has changed in nature over the past few years, but of course, any missed strikes by the Saudis today just bring back the memories of the campaign that was so brutal for many, many years on the ground. But when we're looking at how the Saudis have perpetuated the war, they are in a little bit of a catch-22 where they fundamentally see the Houthis as a significant threat on their border. General McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, testified last week in front of Congress about the Iranian proliferation, specifically inside of Yemen, of ballistic missiles and drones that have really created the most significant threat to U.S. forces and our partners in the region. The Saudis feel this immensely. They are the victim of hundreds of attacks from Yemen from the Houthis. And what they are looking to do is to ensure the Houthis are not in a position to continue to threaten them. So, of course, that creates the cycle where the Saudis are looking to end the war, but actually can't win this war. And they can't win it for many, many reasons. But they're also unable to negotiate for peace because the Houthis still have these Iranian-sourced weapons. And on the other side, Iran has happily provided the Houthis with these weapons over the course of the past 7 years. It's deepened its relationships. There are Hezbollah actors on the ground. The IRGC is on the ground. Iranian proxies inside of Iraq have offered to support the Houthis. It's only been rhetorical to date, but we've seen Houthi tactics move from Yemen to Iraq. So when we're talking about the Houthi integration into the Iranian threat network, the axis of resistance, as it's known, that has really consolidated over the course of this war and really pulled Yemen into this intractable Saudi-Iranian conflict, which is unfortunate for the Yemenis themselves because it complicates the solution to the war on the ground.
Over to you, Nedwa, for your interpretation of how this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran backing opposing sides and vying for influence in the region, how has that made it much more difficult to reach a ceasefire, let alone any kind of a long-term peace accord?
The Saudis' rivalry with Iran, of course, I mean, Yemen is now a fighting ground between the Saudis and the Iranians. Having said that, I think what prolonged the war are different factors, including Saudis' own incompetence and lack of vision. We've seen the Houthis over the past years demonstrate how they're unwilling to compromise or come to the table in good faith. The Houthis have rained Saudis with hundreds of ballistic missiles and suicide drones. Every time we achieve a ceasefire, the Saudis and the Yemeni government forces comply, while the Houthis take that as an opportunity to regroup and expand militarily. And that happened in 2018 when the Stockholm Agreement was signed. What happened was that the Houthis took that opportunity and regrouped their forces, repositioned their forces, and made significant military gain east of Sana'a. And now they're threatening Marib, which is the last stronghold of the Yemeni government. The Houthis and Iran are strong allies. So the Houthis are part and parcel of Iran's axis of resistance, and their objectives are clear in that sense. The Houthis state that they want to capture all Yemen, and they're the only people who represent Yemenis, and that after Yemen, they want to liberate Mecca and Jerusalem. And that's not joke. That's not propaganda. That is actually their political ideology. At the same time, you have the Saudis who intervened militarily in Yemen. They completely underestimated the Houthis, and they've been relying mainly on airstrikes. They're not relying on ground operations. The forces that are backed by the Saudis are not given enough support. They're not giving enough weapons. They're not getting enough training. And then on the other hand, you have the Emiratis who support forces that are fighting with the Yemeni government. And all that have played into the hands of the Houthis. So the divergent agendas between the Emiratis and the Saudis in Yemen have actually contributed to the Houthis having the upper hand militarily in Yemen so far. At the same time, you have the Yemeni government, who is extremely incompetent and pretty much lives abroad, corrupt, and basically we lack leadership as Yemenis. We don't have leadership, political leadership that can kind of bring all the anti-Houthi forces together and kind of force the Houthis to come to the negotiation table in good faith. So all these factors are prolonging the war, you know, competition or rivalry between Iran and the Saudis aside, all these forces in Yemen together have contributed to prolonging the war and Yemeni suffering.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Catherine Zimmerman. She's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Nadwa Dawsari, from whom you just heard, a Yemeni analyst and non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute here in Washington. We're discussing the aspects of the conflict in Yemen as the war rages into its eighth year. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Kazim Naimi. He's a peace and human rights activist from Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about Yemen. And back to you, Katie. You know, the question that comes to me is, how does this end? Do we remain in this stalemate? Where do you see a possibility for any kind of, first of all, the talk of this truce for Ramadan, which is just around the corner? What is the role of the UN, the special envoy? And what about Tim Lenderking, who is the U.S. special envoy for Yemen? Do we have a role in bringing the parties together? What kind of leverage do we have?
I wish I saw a greater opportunity for peace inside of Yemen, but certainly we can hope for a ceasefire during Ramadan. I think that actually is a possibility, though I would be concerned that the various actors on the ground will use ceasefires as they have in the past to reset and prepare for another round of fighting rather than really to launch into longer term negotiations. I think the fundamental challenge is that it is stalemated, and the Houthis are working hard to generate a new generation of fighters amongst youth in terms of indoctrination and training among children and the young people that have lived under their control now for 7+ years, while the other factions in Yemen, some of the southerners and the tribes, are lacking really cohesive support either from the Yemeni government, which, as Nadwa noted, is quite absent, or the fact that their Gulf backers have tired of the Yemeni war and have somewhat cut and run as much as they can and still feel as though their interests are secure. What this means is that there's really not going to be a military shift in the fight. And the question of the day really is how to bring fundamentally the Houthis, who've had the initiative for the past few years, to the table in a way that they are willing to accept some of the terms that would be required for the security, I would say, from an American perspective, but also for the Saudis to accept it and the regional actors, and something that would be more legitimate for the Yemeni people. Because what has gotten lost in all of this is that the Houthis did seize power illegally in September of 2014. They negotiated an agreement then, but it really was an agreement by force and fiat, not by referendum for the Yemeni people. So, you know, when you're looking at this, certainly the role of the UN diplomats and our American diplomat, Tim Lenderking, is important. But I don't believe that international negotiators are going to find the solution through diplomacy. There needs to be something that shifts inside of Yemen. It will have to be something that comes out of Yemen, where either factions decide that they're willing to give up what they've been fighting for, which I see as fairly unlikely, or something really tips the balance on the ground and we see capitulations. And again, I'm not sure what those would be other than fatigue, really, of this war. So as we're looking ahead and trying to determine how that happens, you know, my recommendations have little to do with pursuing peace inside of Yemen these days, simply because we've seen so many windows of opportunity close, and much more about trying to limit what is going into Yemen that is helping to prolong the war. So finding ways, for example, to prevent the Iranians from continuing to smuggle some of their advanced weaponry into Yemen would start to change the dynamic.
Nadwa Dawsari, how would you see any kind of resolution based on what Catherine just said?
I second everything that Katie said. Unfortunately, I don't see an end in sight. The problem is that none of the actors that are now trying to pursue peace or encourage Yemenis to come to peace have leverage on the actors. Nobody has leverage on the Houthis. Even Iran does not have the leverage that we think it does on the Houthis. And the problem, again, is that the actors that now have the ability to stop and end the war, they're profiting from the war. The Houthis are making billions and billions of riyals, that's hundreds of millions of dollars every month in the war economy and extortion. Same on the other side, all these factions in the south, they're making tons of money from the war economy. The Hadi government is abroad, and the officials, ministers, deputy ministers, officials in Yemeni government who live abroad, they're making salaries in thousands of dollars a month. They're paid in hard currency. Why would they want to come back to Yemen and be paid in Yemeni riyals and not be able to afford the rent? So all these factors are just creating incentives to continue the war, not to stop it. Unfortunately, I don't see any end in sight anytime soon. I think this will continue to be a low-intensity conflict for the foreseeable future. And I agree with Katie. There has to be some shift on the ground. And I would say it more explicitly. There has to be a military shift where the Houthis in particular are weakened militarily. Without weakening the Houthis militarily, it would be impossible to bring them to the negotiation table. And right now, the Houthis are the ones that are mainly obstructing reaching a political solution because of their unwillingness to engage in the peace negotiations and their maximalized position. And so, again, without weakening the Houthis militarily, we're not going to see any progress in the peace process.
As we close very quickly, Catherine, what could weaken the Houthis militarily? Nadwa just said that the Iranians don't have a lot of influence on them, but I don't know what would persuade the Iranians to withhold support. I don't know whether the Iran deal, if it's signed, if that has anything to do with anything, but what are your final words?
In terms of weakening the Houthis inside of Yemen militarily, the relationship with Iran is actually a bit moot. The Iranians certainly provide military assistance and support to the Houthis. It's no doubt that they've transferred the expertise to build improvised explosive devices, so fundamentally landmines and sea mines, and they provided the Houthis with drones and other assets that the Houthis have used militarily. But much of what the Iranians are providing on that end is higher end and is being used against the Saudis and the Emiratis outside of Yemen. And so when we're looking at reducing the Houthi influence inside of Yemen, it's not going to come from Iran by any means. I think Ned was exactly right. Iran can help the Houthis in terms of providing them with the means to expand the scope of the conflict, but Iran has no way to stop this conflict, and it's certainly going to be pumping money in if it can, when it becomes flush with funds, should there be sanctions relief. But then on the other side, even blanket sanctions against the Houthis, the FTO, Foreign Terrorist Organization designation, which has become so contentious of the Houthi movement, when we look at FTO designations against other similar groups that have held terrain. Let's look at the Islamic State, for example. The funds on the ground and the control over territory is the most crucial aspect of the organization's ability to generate wealth. And the Houthis will retain that regardless of their designation. There are certain aspects, of course, that it will affect. But I really do think that when we're looking at this fight, it's going to have to come from Yemenis opposing the Houthis and some way to unify the force, to actually create a force that is well-funded and organized, the way that Nedwa pointed out. Otherwise, we're going to see this sustained, very low-intensity, stalemated conflict inside of the country.
Well, I'm afraid on that very pessimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Nadwa Dalsari, a Yemeni analyst and non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. Thank you, ladies, for your insights and terrific analysis. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.